Talk given Friday, 29th December 1972. We have already seen, up to a point, that the gods of the Rig Veda, like the gods of all the pantheons of the different civilizations of the world, represent transcendentally human characteristics and human potentialities. We have dealt so far with Varuna, the moral governor of the universe, who is the embodiment of transcendent virtue as such, and we have dealt with Indra, who is described as the personal lord of heaven. And we have tried to see in which ways Varuna and Indra function within us ourselves. Now, last time, we should have dealt with Agni, the god of fire. But it happened that the meeting became a question and answer meeting and a very nice discussion group. So we naturally did not have time to consider Agni. I will say just a few words about Agni, and we'll pass on from Agni to Soma. Agni, as you know, is the god of fire, our Latin word ignis, and of course our English words like ignition and so forth are derived from the Sanskrit root Agni. And this fire in us is represented in so many ways. There is, for example, the simple fact of the temperature of the body. There is the fact that all the metabolic processes, all the processes of life, biologically as well as psychologically and spiritually, have the element of heat, of fire about them. There is, as far as our bodily life is concerned, very definitely sexual fire, which every human being knows of, more often than not to his cost and difficulty. There is digestive fire, as we say. Then we have what we call the fire of inspiration, the fire of speech, the fire of passion, the fire of the emotions, whether they be the pleasant ones or whether they be the unpleasant ones, the fire of ideas, and so on. So we have this element fire playing its part in our lives. And for those who are interested in the yogic aspect, this fire can be associated with the various psychical centers, as they are called, which are also associated with specific parts of the body. Now, there is one aspect which is peculiarly important for us. It is important for us who are concerned with the living of the holy life, which means the realization of transcendence. But in order that transcendence may be realized, made real, all that which obstructs transcendence in our own being must of necessity be transformed. Now you all know that ordinarily we talk about burning up the dross in our nature, burning up the evil things. And we are inclined to regard this burning up as a destruction of that which is evil or undesirable, and a rejection of evil. Now, in actual fact, where we human beings are concerned, nothing can be rejected, nothing can be thrown out. It is part of our actual being. Our qualities, whether we call them good or bad, are merely the different shapes in actual daily action taken by our psychical energy. Now, our psychical energy constitutes the psyche. If, for example, you are seized with a cramp in your hand, we'll say, you don't cut off your hand and throw it away. It's very foolish. It'll be a permanent loss and a permanent defect. You wait until the cramp has gone, or you do what is necessary in order to be free of it, and that is all. You have transformed the ill condition into the normal, healthy condition. This is the point we must bear in mind with regard to the holy life, and we forget it all the time, that the livingness of the mind is like the livingness of the body. You don't destroy, you don't throw away, you don't cut off, you transform, you restore to the state of wholeness. So now, Agni, the Lord of Fire, burns the whole being of the person. It's a literal fact that the body burns, which is the process of living. It's an oxidation process and so forth. We all know that. It's a burning process. But if it burns in the right way, there is released health and well-being. Now, it's identically the same with the psyche. This burning process which goes on within ourselves is to be attributed or associated with, I should say, the archetypal concept of the god Agni. And the wonderful thing is this, that Agni burns up dross and metal alike and transforms it into the pure gold of true, harmonious, perfect human being. It changes us, in other words, from the subhuman condition in which all humanity is caught up into the true human condition. What we call the perfected man, the Mahatma, or the Savior, or the liberated one, or use whatever term you like, the Son of God, or Son of Man, or whichever term you like, is the true human. We must never forget that. And it's so easy to forget it, because both our heritage from the very beginning of time, as well as our so-called upbringing and education, conditions us in the wrong way. And so we have this misconception that a human being is one who is full of flaws and troubles and ill states and all the rest of it, and we accept that as normal. That is subnormal. The true human being is the perfect human being. You take a flower, take any flower you like. Look at that flower. It is perfect in itself, isn't it? Now, each kingdom produces its flowers, and all flowers are perfect things in themselves. But it is not so with us humans. We are not the full flower of humanity. And we have to grow into that flower of humanity. Not manufacture it. Not picture. Make an image in our minds of what the perfect man ought to be, and then try to work up to it. Because that is a mechanical process. It is a synthetic activity, a putting together of little bits and bobs. And that is not the way of life. Life grows everything. It's a growing, it's a power to make, to grow. And we have to grow into our fulfillment. And the extraordinary thing about growing into our fulfillment is that although we are, every one of us is a human being, every one of us is a unique human being. And although every one of us can be a representative flower of humanity, every one of us is a different flower from all the other 3,500 million such human beings on the face of the globe. Now, in this growing process, Agni, the Lord of Fire, plays his part and releases the perfection out of each being. This must be clearly realized. This fire is life-giving. It is warming. It is comforting in the real sense. That is to say, strength-giving, health-producing. Psychologically, spiritually. This fire of Agni. And this fire burns inside the mind. So when we, as a result of our aspiration and endeavor, experience that fire, we mustn't be afraid of it. This is what we do at first. We become afraid. Oh, what's this happening? Oh, I don't know where I am. I'm losing my bearings. Don't be afraid of it. Never be afraid of such things. Because this is the process of transformation. And it will take place inside your own psychophysical being in your own unique way. There is no need to let anybody interfere with that. Let it happen. Watch it. Sometimes one needs to save oneself from the consequences of having made some misjudgment in the process. All right? Consider it together with somebody who cares for you, who really cares, and who is balanced in mind. And then, out of such mutual consideration, any apparent ill effects of the activity of that fire can be dealt with in the right way. This inner fire in the mind, watch it. It's very important. It is very powerful. But it releases the perfect man. And this is Agni. Agni is presented in the Rig Veda in threefold form. Symbolically, it's presented. The sun in the heavens, the heavenly fire. Lightning in the air, what is known as the middle region. They call the atmosphere or air the middle region. But air, remember, in the old scriptures of the world, or sometimes they just use the word wind, represents the spirit in one. What in Christian terms is called the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost, the Greek pneuma. See, this is the mid-region, air. Transcendence itself is beyond this. Holy Spirit in oneself, as we call it. And then the third aspect of Agni is the fire on the altar on earth or on your hearth. The fire on the hearth is Agni, the third place. And Agni is regarded as the friend of man, the messenger of the gods. He is called son, brother, father, all sorts of wonderful things like this. You see the remarkable sort of sense of familiarity in association with Agni, which is rather greater than the sense of familiarity which the Rig Vedic seers expressed in relation to several, or I should almost say most of the other gods. But Agni is something homely. He is on your home fire. He is the purifier of the sinful state. He is also called the punisher of guilt. He is also known as the interceder. The idea of the mediator is an extremely old one, of course. And he is regarded as the mediator between oneself, because he is right on your heart. He is here with you every day. He intercedes for you with Varuna, who, as moral governor of the universe, is regarded as judge. Now, if we are wise, when we study things like the Rig Veda, we would look deeply into ourselves and see how these things operate. All the gods are symbolic representations of great archetypal energies which are real. The gods are our picture. We make them in our images. You see, they are a picture. They don't exist as individual beings at all. They exist only so long as man will remember them. That is all. Who knows about the gods of man 10,000 years back and further back? No one knows anything about them. They have faded. All those gods have gone to their eternal rest. The gods that we know of are the ones which have been written about, of which there is a record or an image or a picture, or is carried in our imagination or memory. We are the creators of these gods. And therefore these gods are only symbols. They have no real substantial reality at all. They are symbolic. But they are symbolic of energies which are real energies that operate right through the universe. This is an important fact to bear in mind. So, remember this about Agni, fire, this element of warmth, which is present, therefore, in our connections, our relationships with the other gods, which means the other aspects of our own being. And they are all archetypal energies. Do remember that. They are archetypal energies and applicable to all mankind, wherever we may be. I think we must pass on from Agni today and go on to Soma. Soma is one of the most elusive of the gods to all scholars. there is a very large number of hymns dedicated to Soma, complete hymns. The whole of the ninth book of the Rig Veda, for instance, containing some 114 or 15 hymns, consists of hymns which are solely hymns to Soma, not to the other gods. The other books have a mixture. Some are to Indra, some Varuna, some Soma, Brihaspati, Rudra, and so on. But the whole of the ninth book is dedicated to Soma, every single hymn. Obviously, there is some peculiar importance to be attached to Soma. But the Rig Veda hides the knowledge of Soma very considerably by introducing the idea of the Soma plant from which a juice was extracted. The juice which was physically supposed to be very exhilarating and in fact which took you into, put you into an exalted condition. Now, this physical aspect is the one which has rather blinded the eyes of scholars. You know, in quite recent times, at least two very distinguished scholars in the world say that the Soma plant actually is a mushroom. There is an American scholar and one of our own scholars, both of them, they call Soma a mushroom. Now, the fundamental ritual of the Rig Veda is the extraction of the Soma juice. And in the ritual which is performed, there is actually a plant which is ground, the juice is extracted, then the last little remnants of it are mixed with water and hand-pressed so that you get all the possible juice out of it, and so forth. And there's an extremely elaborate ritual which has been built up around Soma, this juice which is extracted. It has its correspondence also in the Iranian, the Avastan, Homa. Of course, Homa and Soma are the same thing. The Iranians had an H, where the Rig Vedic people had an S. You see, for example, take the river Indus. The Indus River was the Sindhu River for the Rig Vedic Indians, and it was the Hindu River for the Iranians. You see, the H and the S are interchangeable terms. We have talked about this when we have discussed hue and sue, and they mean perfect or happy. There is the other root, sue, which means to press out of. You see, and so forth. We need not digress too much into philology at the moment. Now, this juice, which was extracted and taken, has its very deep psycho-spiritual significance. Let me read just a few verses out of one of the hymns in the 10th book of the Rig Veda. Truth is the base that bears the earth. By Surya, that is the sun, are the heavens sustained. By law, and in this instance, law is Ritta, the eternal order of the whole universe, the inherent order in all that is. The Adityas, that is, the sons of the unbound Adityas, they are the gods, the great gods of the Rig Veda, stand secure, and Soma holds his place in heaven. By Soma are the Adityas strong. By Soma mighty is the earth. Thus Soma, in the midst of all these constellations, hath his place. Now listen very carefully at the third verse, to the third verse. One thinks, when they have brayed the plant, that he hath drunk the Soma's juice, of whom Brahmins truly know as Soma, no one ever tasted. Soma, concealed by covering rules, guarded by hymns, thou standest listening to the stones. None tastes of thee who dwells on earth. In spite of a hymn like that, scholars will still confine themselves to mushrooms and goodness knows what not. Now, from another hymn, which is extremely important. Place me in that deathless, undecaying world wherein the light of heaven is set and everlasting luster shines. Make me immortal in that realm where dwells the king, Vivasvan's son, that is Yama, who was the first mortal who crossed over death and was granted, became immortal and was granted lordship over the highest of the three heavens. You see, remember St. Paul talking about being caught up in the third heaven in 2 Corinthians, isn't it? Yes, it's in 2 Corinthians. Make me immortal in that realm where dwells the king, Vivasvan's son, Yama, the lord of death. Make me where there is that secret shrine of heaven, where there are those waters young and fresh, the waters of everlasting life, young and fresh. Make me immortal in that realm where they move even as they list, in the third sphere of inmost heaven, where lucid worlds are full of light. Now, when you find a sentence like this, where they move even as they list, make me mortal in that realm where they move even as they list. This movement is in the deep states of consciousness. It has nothing to do with any sort of spatial movement, obviously. It is in the deep states of consciousness where you move as you will. But the will has no relationship to human desire, no relationship to motivation by curiosity, and so on. This is a movement in the deeps of consciousness, which can take place when the mind is utterly purified, when it is still and silent, and it is the god Soma who is addressed in this hymn. Make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire, the region of the golden sun, where food and full delight are found. Now, of course, here the translation naturally misleads the man who merely thinks about these things. That realm of eager wish and strong desire. And we immediately think in terms of our own wishing and desiring and so forth. And then when you get the region of the golden sun, where food and full delight are found, naturally one is inclined to say, what hedonistic people, what primitive folk just looking for the delights of sense in the heaven world. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the delights of sense in the heaven world. Eager wish and strong desire. If you look in the Upanishads, for instance, you will find it clearly stated how he whose desire, whose whole desire is the ultimate real, whose longing is the ultimate real, and the term used for ultimate real is Atma, of course, you see, realizes, they use the term gains, that ultimate real. His wishes are fulfilled. Again and again it is said in the Upanishads, as well as in so many other Brahmanical scriptures, that so-and-so, a holy one, then attained immortality and fulfilled all his desires. But all his desires are just the one desire for that ultimate real, Atma or Brahman, whichever term you like to use. And that is what that means. The region of the golden sun, Aditya, the sun in the unclouded heavens, represents the state of complete enlightenment. Now, in the region of enlightenment, obviously there are no beefsteaks or vegetable pies or fruit salads or some such thing like that. So, when we talk of food and full delight are found, obviously it has no meaning other than spiritual sustenance. And this spiritual sustenance is an extraordinary thing. You will find again in the Upanishads, this comes in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It, talking of Brahman and the realization of Brahman, it consumes nothing so ever. No one so ever consumes it. Now, if you take food in the ordinary sense, food is something which is consumed by the creature or the plant taking in its sustenance. It is consumed, it is transformed, part is assimilated, part is rejected. Nothing like that happens where the transcendent real is concerned. You see, one has to really meditate on this. That is to say, be quiet and let the mind be very restful, but very awake, calmly, restfully awake. Not tensely awake. Not seeking to know, because this knowing can never take place in terms of ordinary mental knowing, intellectual knowing. It is not a ratiocinative process. There are no logical steps which lead you to a final conclusion. Nothing of the sort. This knowing is identical with being the thing. And this being the thing is a perpetual, rhythmic, throbbing, living process of the inmost reality within you. So one has to be completely quiet, harmonious, poised. And then one understands what this communion is like. There's nothing static about it. There is nothing dynamic in the sense of a motion, a movement of translation, of being carried across from here to there. Because there is no distinction of here and there in those states, the deep states of consciousness. See, these are the things that can only come to one in realization, personal realization, which is also an impersonal realization. It, the totality, realizes. And that gets manifested in time and space through you or you or you, the living human being. See, if we really see this, we will get rid of this foolish passion to achieve and attain paradise or heaven or nirvana or whatever it is. You can't achieve, attain, or get there. Because that's all that belongs to the realm of the finite, the particular. The realm where there is manyness, there is separateness. But in this state of consciousness, where you, the finite being, are aware in terms of the infinite, and therefore of the immortal, there is nothing to gain or achieve, because everything is there. That state of consciousness itself is its own, if one may say so, gaining. And by the same token, it itself is its own losing. Separate self completely lost. The one and only total being is there. And you see, man can do this. If man can't do this, I couldn't even speak of it. Don't you see? The talkable, let's just say, not stupidly talked, but which has sense in it and substantial reality in it, the talkable is possible only because there is this truth about it. Therefore, it is man who realizes these things. You see, whenever you are caught up in that state, caught up in the third heaven, as St. Paul said, whenever you are caught up in that state, just remain quietly awake and get the real feel of it. It's the feel of it which will transform the psyche. And you will find that when it transforms the psyche, so many problems of mental confusion, problems of anxiety, problems of conflict, of upset, and so forth, they all disappear because the psyche becoming pure prevents influences from outside from producing the ill state in the psyche, which we experience as anxiety and fear and anger and conflict and all the rest of it. You see? So, and when the psyche gets transformed that way, so many petty little desires and pursuits and weaknesses in our nature, as we call them, you find yourself suddenly without them. The old familiar devils have gone. But they haven't gone. Because instead of the old familiar devils, you will find that there are so many, at first, unfamiliar angels present. Those same psychical energies have been transformed. And this is the important thing. Now you see, the whole of the Rig Vedic ritual, and it is still practiced to this day. And there are occasions when, if you are fortunate enough, that's the simple way in which I can express it, if you are fortunate enough, you might come across such a ceremonial magic, the real thing. It's extremely rare to come across it because there are so few who are capable of celebrating the ritual in that manner. You might come across it and it will be an unforgettable experience because you yourself will be changed. I've met one or two people of this type who have been through it. And it's simply quite extraordinary. So in the form of this ritual sacrificial process, the Soma ritual, of taking actual physical plants and extracting the juice, etc. But all that is associated with it by the celebrants themselves in terms of their thought, their concentrated psychical, mental energy upon the whole process and upon the people around get transformed. This is how all ceremonies in churches of any sort, whether they be Christian or Buddhist or Hindu or temple, whatever they are, temples, churches, mosques, that's how the ceremonial should be carried out. But that is an art which is practically lost. They can't do it now. So now, this business about make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire, the region of the golden sun, the realm of enlightenment, where food and full delight is found. Make me immortal, this is the last verse here, make me immortal in that realm where happiness and transports, where joys and felicities combined, and longing wishes are fulfilled. Now do remember, none of these things mean what they mean for us mortals in our ordinary psychophysical life. Nothing at all of that. This is something totally different. All these longing wishes, these felicities, these joys, and so forth, something totally different. They are non-sensational. They are not conceivable. They are totally experienceable. And whatsoever is totally experienceable is something which is quite beyond the possibility of description in thought and word. We all experience this sometime or other, in some way or other, in our own personal lives. Something wonderful happens, truly wonderful. It may be the song of a bird. It may be the sudden sight of a starry night. The whole heaven absolutely glittering with the stars. Or the sight of a boat sailing on a calm sea with the sunlight shining on the sails. Any of these things, the smile of a baby, or even its little howling, suddenly calls up within you in all its fullness, for a fraction of a moment, the whole experience of the transcendent. And in that moment, a magic has taken place in you and left a permanent impress. But you can't analyze it and describe it. And don't try to. Don't try to analyze and describe it, the thing that happened. Let it inspire you to speak, to write poems, to paint pictures, to build houses or anything, which are the product of that creative impulse. That's all right. That's a different matter. But don't try to grasp the vision of God and fix it. If you do, you will merely have a dead picture, not the living God. That is the point. So now, Soma, the great god Soma, stands really for our condition of inspiration. This inspiration in which we are actually in communion with transcendence. Transcendence is not out there, something to which I aspire and desire that I will get to it. No, it is not that. It is here now, in realization. But it is the condition of inspiration. Take it at its most concrete level, the body itself. When we breathe in, inspiration as we call it, what do we take in? That without which the bodily life would vanish, absolutely vanish. This is inspiration. That without which our spiritual being and life would absolutely vanish is the inspiration represented by Soma. Soma, it is said, is the one who confers immortality. All the gods long to drink the Soma, as they call it. You see, you have it in all the different mythologies of the world. The gods on Olympus, Mount Olympus, they all drink the nectar and the ambrosia and so forth. Ambrosia is related to the Sanskrit word amrita. Amrita, ambrosia. And amrit literally means not death. Mrityu is death, and amrit is not death. It negates death. You see? But you see, in which way it negates death? Not by saying no to it. Not by trying to run away from it, to avoid it. Not by trying to do things which will prevent death from coming. Far from it. This is the great mistake that mankind makes and has made through the ages. Death is here now, together with what we commonly call life. Death is other life. Life as experienced now by us in the moment disappears in the next fraction of a moment, but it has not disappeared in the sense of being annihilated. It has disappeared in the sense of being utterly transformed. How is it transformed? That is to say, in which manner is it transformed? Life as you and I know it here in our waking consciousness is of a finite nature. In its dying, and if we don't try to grasp it, if we really let it go, that finitude becomes infinity. Being becomes non-being. Non-being is, and only can be, one only. The one only non-being expresses, that is, presses out of itself innumerable beings. Now, our experience as beings here is of such a nature that we associate life only with being, which is not the truth. When being lets go of itself, it dies, it becomes non-being. The finite has gone back to the infinite, in which there is absoluteness. There is no sorrow there. There is no pleasure there either. There is that extraordinary blissful state, the peace of God which passeth understanding, as it is put in Christian terminology, the ananda of Brahman. There is that which is translated in this hymn as joys, felicities, transports, and so on. You see, if we can learn to be truly contented and entirely happy with not knowing the future, the development, the end, the fulfillment, the perfection, then the whole of it will be there. But every time I seek to know it, to lift the veil, so to say, and try to see in my petty little terms what the infinite is, I only see a little fragment and mistake it for the eternal reality. You see, how profound, for instance, is the teaching of the Buddha, cease from all grasping. Again and again he said, the cessation of all grasping is nirvana. This is eternal bliss. Not eternal pleasure, or pleasant sensation, or an agreeable condition. Eternal bliss, nirvana. Very different. So you see, this life-death pulsation, which takes place with incredible rapidity, and we human beings, out of our ignorance and our greed, try to prevent life from pulsating into death. We try to prevent the finite from pulsating into the infinite. Then the infinite expresses the finite again. But if you leave God alone to do His business, the totality of our life and the universe would be just heavenly and nothing else. But we are perpetually interfering with the divine activity by our desires and by our fears and our possessiveness. How then can we enjoy heaven which is here now, right within us? If you read the hymns to Soma, and of course all the hymns of the Rig Veda are very difficult to penetrate into. You have to have years and years of deep meditation with respect to them. But if you do study the hymns, then study them in terms of experiencing in your inner consciousness that which the seers represented in so many words. This is important.